Croeso cynnes iawn I ar y Prydain. A very warm welcome to ARUP in London tonight. My name is Ben Pritchard and I work for ARUP based in our office in Wales. I'm pleased to see so many people with an interest in Wales here tonight, especially on the day we have secured our passage to the knockout stages of the Rugby World Cup. Just. But we won't just be talking about Wales, we will be talking about Scotland too, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing about the Scottish perspectives. We have the benefits of the facilities here tonight till 10 o'clock. After the debate, there will be drinks and some nibbles in the atrium. So please do stay if you're able to. In terms of housekeeping, there is Wi-Fi available. There's two of these at the back of the room, but the connection is to Nyquist/guest. The username is visitor.wireless, and the password is Queensferry with capital Q. And I'll leave these at the back of the room if you would like that. Toilets are on this level, so just past the stairs through the atrium. And there is no fire alarm test planned, so if we do need to vacate the building, the fire exit are straight out through the doors and straight ahead of you. And the muster point will be at Fitzroy Square. So ARUP is a company that really does embrace debate and challenge. We regularly hold internal sessions on the most challenging topics of the day. We are also wholly non-partisan and without any political affiliation. This is important to state given the political atmosphere we are all coping with. We host tonight's event as a proud member of the Institute of Welsh Affairs and as an organisation that regularly works for Cardiff University, supporting it to achieve its goals. I'm sure I speak for many here tonight when I say that my ARUP colleagues and I want to contribute to the future success of Wales and Scotland, and for that success to be inclusive and equitable. It is my pleasure to welcome to the stage Colin Reardon, Vice Chancellor from Cardiff University, to introduce the event. Enjoy the debate. Diolch yn
Diolch, Ben. Noswaith dda, a diolch I chi gyd am ddod heno. Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for making the time and coming tonight. Cardiff University is very proud to be working with our partners, the IWA and ARUP and Edinburgh University, to bring you this latest in the series of debates that Ben's referred to. We do think they've been a great forum to be able to discuss major areas of public policy in Wales, and to help policymakers at a UK level to understand the opportunities that exist in Wales for genuine policy and economic innovation. And tonight's topic obviously is no exception. It does give us a chance to reflect not just on Welsh devolution, but on the wider devolution journey in Scotland as well, and what the current Brexit travails may mean for the future. So we're very grateful to the Institute of Welsh Affairs and the University of Edinburgh for helping us to assemble such a strong panel. I mean, it really is great, and to draw such a broad and engaged audience. Now, it will come as no surprise to you that we at Cardiff University are concerned over what any future Brexit settlement might mean for devolution and for us as a university. We have been reasonably vocal about what Brexit might mean for our overseas staff and students, for our students from and staff from the rest of the European Union, and of course for our research and innovation networks. But for those of us in the devolved nations, and Wales in particular, there is an additional concern about how funds that are currently distributed by the EU might be delivered post-Brexit. This is not just about Horizon 2020, and Erasmus Plus, but about structural funds, which really are critical to us. Since 2000, we've received around all Welsh universities, that is, not just Cardiff, unfortunately, around £570 million from the European Structural Funds Programme. So it's pretty critical to us. And that there's all kinds of other ways in which we have benefited. And it's because of this that we are concerned about any new arrangement like the UK Shared Prosperity Fund, and would like to know that Wales won't lose out from that, because it does actually constitute about 25% of our funding. We have made this point on a number of occasions. We've argued that one element of that should be that any new funding regime should be devolved by design, so that the devolution settlement's respected, and that decisions about how to spend money in Wales are taken in Wales. And I'm sure that similar discussions are happening in Scotland. It will be interesting to hear what the panel has to say about these kinds of issues. So I do hope that you enjoy this evening's debate and that you can contribute with your thoughts and questions later. And also during proceedings, if you want to use Twitter by using the hashtag IWADebate. And as you've heard, there'll be an opportunity to stay on afterwards for a glass of wine to discuss the issues further. I'd very much like to thank ARUP for their support in hosting today's events or tonight's events. We're very grateful for that. We're hoping that the next event, the next debate, will be in January, and that should take place in Cardiff on a topic that's yet to be confirmed, but we'll let you know about that in due course. So it's now a great pleasure to hand over to Kieran Jenkins from Channel 4 News, who's going to chair tonight's discussion. Kieran's the ideal chair for a debate like this, who brings his detailed knowledge both of Wales and Scotland and a broader, obviously, informed view of the issues we're talking about tonight. So thank you very much indeed, Kieran. Diolch yn fawr.
Evening, Mark Smith there, Croeso. Going to be an interesting, exciting, informative discussion, hopefully, on the future of devolution in the inescapable context of that great, looming, unanswerable that is Brexit. As Professor Reardon said, I'm Kieran Jenkins, Scotland correspondent with Channel 4 News. I formerly worked in Wales at the BBC, so I'm very well devo-credentialed in an industry in which too few journalists perhaps are Devo curious. But on this panel we have Devo royalty. So let me introduce them. Richard Wynne-Jones is director of Cardiff University's Wales Governance Centre and Dean of Public Affairs and has written extensively on contemporary Welsh politics, devolved politics in the UK and nationalism. We have Professor Ailsa Henderson, Professor of Political Science at the University of Edinburgh. She is an expert made for this very moment because her publications explore how national identity, federalism, devolution or institutional design can affect regional variations in political attitudes or behaviours. I'm going to find out a bit more about what all that means in a minute. We have Stephen Crabb here, who is the Conservative MP for Preseli, Pembrokeshire since 2005. Previously served as Government Whip, Secretary of State for Wales, no less, and Secretary of State for Department for Work and Pensions. And finally, Sir Paul Silk, who chaired the Commission on Devolution to Wales between 2012 and 2014, having spent his professional career as clerk in the House of Commons and in the National Assembly for Wales, as well as a period of civil servant in the Northern Ireland office. So definitely devo-credentialed, I'd say there. And we're asking this evening, after 20 years of devolution, is Brexit the end of devolution? What does it mean for the distribution of powers and funding? What does it mean for identities within the constituent parts of the UK? What does it mean for the future of the UK itself? And Brexit is inevitably a sparky subject, and news watchers that you are, all of you, you'll have seen it is prone to some serious shenanigans, no less so in the last 24 hours, so let's have a more elevated conversation here this evening. Let's step back from the fray and have a considered debate about the future of the balance of powers in the UK. So discussion amongst the panel first, then a Q&A session. It's been live streamed on Twitter, so don't say anything that you'll regret later. And that is the hashtag. There we go. So let's hear first of all from our two presentations, Professor Ailsa Henderson.
Wonderful, thank you. Thanks very much. It's how do I move this on from here? Can I control this? What do I have to press to control? Have you given me power now? No! I'll just keep talking. So thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be here down from the University of Edinburgh and to be let out of my office. My office is sometimes referred to, when my colleagues are in a kind of more expansionist, imperialist mood, as the Scottish branch office of the Wales Governance Centre North. So it's with one volunteer employee. And I have to say, when I was when the publicity for this event was first coming out, it was what surprised me as an outsider was the utter outrage that it was not being offered in Cardiff, and the anger from people that they couldn't spend a Wednesday night in Cardiff talking about devolution and Brexit was just something to behold. And I think even though things we're very well engaged in Scotland, it is really something that we would look on with jealousy in terms of the level of engagement and interest and willingness to talk about these things. So while the slides are sorting out, one thing I wanted to talk about was just I won't speak for very long. Today we have some data for you from the Future of England survey, and Richard's going to speak a little bit about the data from the British Election survey. We'll be talking today about mostly the 2018 data. The 2019 fieldwork for England, Scotland and Wales is completed. It's still currently in the field for Northern Ireland, so you'll hear more from us soon about that. What I wanted to talk about was two things. One, what was the Union like before Brexit, and then what have been possible consequences of Brexit? And the first thing I would say is that the Union is a union in which there is a considerable level of grievance among the territorial units. And so that grievance extends to whether people feel that they have their fair share and access to resources, but also in terms of influence. So if we look at some of the figures that we've collected in the past, we ask a question about whether people feel that they get more than their fair share or less than their fair share of resources. And if we ask them whether people feel that they get less than their fair share, then everyone says, yes, my part gets less than its fair share. So people in Wales believe they get less than their fair share. People in Scotland believe that they get less than their fair share. And the same is true in England. But if we ask people, well, who gets more, then outside of England, there is a general consensus that in England, that it is England that gets more than its fair share, except in England where everyone thinks that it's Scotland that gets more than its fair share, right? So there's a general sense that people can feel their own part gets less and other parts get more. If we extend on from that, am I able to scroll through it? Hey, power and data. I get slightly edgy when I don't have my figures in front of me, right? So this is what I was saying earlier. Everyone thinks that they get less than their fair share. So in Scotland, yes, we get less than our fair share. In Wales, well, no, we get less than our fair share. In Northern Ireland, no, I think you'll find that we get less than their fair share. But another way that we can look at it is by asking people who they would like to share their resources with. If we raise income, should we keep all of that revenue with us in our particular unit, or should we share it with the rest of the UK? So we could ask people that way, or we could ask them a specific way. We could ask them whether they wish to share specifically with Scotland, or they wish to share the resources specifically with Wales, or they wish to share the resources specifically with Northern Ireland. And when we ask it in these four different ways, what we find is that when we ask, do you want to keep it to yourself or share with everybody, then the figures are fairly high. We get variation depending on where you live. Support is higher for sharing if you're in England and in Northern Ireland, less so in terms of Scotland. But when we start to mention specific parts of the UK, then we find, first of all, that those figures immediately drop, and they drop more so for some regions than for others. So particularly less willing to share with, you know, England is, if you mention Scotland, all of a sudden support almost halves in terms of its willingness to share. So how you frame the question very much affects the answers that you get back. And it also frames our understandings of, well, when we say you're sharing, with whom are you happiest to share? And that sense of sharing extends not just to resources, but also to influence. So you recall in the 2015 general election campaign, the Conservative Party was saying, well, you know, watch out if you support the Labour Party, because you might end up with the undue influence of members of the Scottish National Party in your government. And at the time, those who were involved in the campaign were saying that, well, yes, we were talking specifically about the SNP, but what we were actually kind of talking about was Scotland in general. So we wanted to know whether that also extends in kind of the popular imagination. Are people in England unwilling to share influence with other parts of the United Kingdom? And what we find, I mean, there's a lot of information here, but if you just look at this total column here, a third of the English electorate believes that no Scottish MP should ever be in government. Ever. And it increases to 40% if you're asking specifically about members of the SNP. Right? So there is a portion of the English electorate that is unhappy with sharing resources, but also in terms of sharing influence. And that was true before Brexit occurred. Very quickly, what has Brexit done, or another way to think of it is, what has Brexit revealed? And we asked about the possible consequences to the Union in terms of Brexit. We've been asking this question for a number of years. We asked whether people thought that two possible consequences to the Union were worth it in order to take back control or not worth it. And what we find is that, in general, folks are likely to say that the unravelling of the peace process in Northern Ireland is not worth it in order to take back control during Brexit. But when we're talking about a possible second independence referendum in which Scotland votes yes, then in fact it's a bit more even. People in England and in Wales, the majority of them are likely to say, well, actually, yes, Scotland going is worth it in order to take back control. But you might say, well, hang on a minute, that mixes up leavers and remainers. Surely there's a difference there in terms of how leavers and remainers might react to that question. And I've just got two slides here. The first, this is just a question on Northern Ireland. And on the left, we've got the responses to that question, just the people who are saying, yes, it's absolutely worth it in order to take back control via Brexit. So over 80% of leavers in England and Wales and Northern Ireland believe that unravelling of the peace process in Northern Ireland is worth it in order to take back control. And remainers, the figures are markedly lower. But also, if you look at it by national identity, you also see an effect. So those in England who prioritise their English identity are more likely to say it's worth it, less so for people who are British identifiers, and the reverse is true in Scotland. And my last slide here, if we're looking at Scotland, exactly the same pattern, but levels of support are higher. So over 85% in England of leavers in England and Wales and Northern Ireland say that Scotland becoming independent is worth it in order to achieve achieve Brexit. And in terms of national identity, we see the same clear patterns here. I should point out this last thing. The question in Northern Ireland is not phrased in exactly the same way. So what we're looking at here are people who align themselves with the Republican and the Unionist camp. So this red bar here is not people who describe themselves as British, but people who describe themselves as Unionists in Northern Ireland. And what this suggests is that Unionists in Northern Ireland are willing to risk the territorial integrity of the Union in order to take back control via Brexit. So this leads us to conclude that this is a Union that one could say is under considerable centripetal strain. And whether you see that as a risk or an opportunity depends very much on your view of the Constitution. But I'll pass it over to you.
Okay, diolch yn fawr. Thank you. So I'm going to further deepen the problems for the Union by taking a look at the Brexit vote itself. Obviously, there's been a great deal of analysis, a great deal of discussion about how to interpret the 2016 vote. Most of that discussion is actually, in our view, wrong-headed. And it's wrong-headed because, fundamentally, we're all aware of the territorial differentiation in the Brexit vote itself. We're all aware that Scotland voted heavily Remain, Northern Ireland voted solidly Remain, Wales and England both voted more narrowly to leave. We all know that. But in the analysis, almost all the academics analysing the results have done is ignore the results in Scotland and Northern Ireland completely, and often ignore the vote in Wales as well. And their data is almost always England only, and they've built theories on that basis. So we've got these kind of ideas about the left behinds. So there's a classic kind of centre-left reframing of Brexit as it's about socioeconomics. Because if it's about socioeconomics, we know what to do about that. We establish a task force, and we a centre for towns in the north of England. And so, you know, that's a kind of familiar framing. The problem with that is that once you start including the data from Scotland, we don't have good data from Northern Ireland, because UK data collection basically ignores Northern Ireland completely. But we've got Scottish data, we've got Welsh data, we've got English data. And when you actually look at these countries, what you see is that the Brexit vote was fundamentally related to national identity in all three of those places. I'm going to show you that very quickly and talk very quickly about some of the implications. I'm going to start with England, because England is the simplest of the three territories I'm going to talk about. What I'm going to talk about and what I'm going to show you is the relationship. This is 2016 data from the British Election Survey, as Ilse said earlier. We're going to focus on three identity groups: those who feel strongly British only, those who feel strongly English only, and those who feel strongly English and strongly British. And this is the Leave percentage vote in the 2016 referendum, okay? And what you see here is that those who feel British only tended to vote Remain. Once strong English identity comes into the equation, you've got a strong Leave vote, which becomes overwhelming when it's strongly English identity only. And if you model the Brexit vote formally, you will find that everything that you, all the things that you're familiar with, such as, you know, the kind of populist anti-intellectual tropes, anti-immigrant feeling, all those things, yes, they're significant, but so is national identity right through the modelling process. Scotland then gives you in some ways the inverse picture. So in Scotland, we're going to talk about three national identities and their interrelationship. But in terms of Scotland, the largest group by some distance is the strongly Scottish only. The second largest is the British and Scottish. Then you've got a British only group, and then a smaller British and English group, and a smaller, very small English only group, which I keep in for illustrative purposes. These are then the Leave vote percentages by national identity in Scotland. Let's talk about the two ends of the spectrum. The Scottish only voters vote heavily Remain. Almost 3 in 4 vote Remain. On the other end of the spectrum, the English identifiers in Scotland are the most Eurosceptic segment of the population, but English Euroscepticism is kind of muted in the Scottish context for reasons which we can speculate about. So the English in Scotland are less Eurosceptic than the English in England, be they English only or English and British. But the key thing here is the difference between the Scottish only and the Scottish and British. And you get the inverse of what happens in England. In England, you'll recall that when you get strong English identity, you get this surge in Euroscepticism. In Scotland, it's adding the British identity that leads to a surge in Euroscepticism. And without boring you with a lot of work that Ilse and I have been doing and a book we've just finished, one of the interesting things is that the attitudes that align with Englishness, certainly as with regards Europe, the attitudes that align with Englishness in England align with Britishness in Scotland and Wales. Britishness means different things in different parts of the UK. Now, we kind of know that instinctively about Northern Ireland, because that is a Britishness that most of us find slightly strange, if I can say that without being too pejorative. But actually, Britishness means different things in different parts of Britain. And in Scotland and Wales, many of the attitudes that align with Englishness, but not Britishness on its own in England, align with Britishness in Scotland and in Wales. Wales, then, is the most complicated of all, okay? So Wales is very complicated because we have a large English diaspora in Wales, and so we see in Wales all those patterns of identity that you have in England reproduced in Wales, plus you have that kind of relationship you see in Scotland between Welshness and Britishness, or being born in Wales but absolutely not feeling Welsh for whatever reason. So rather than having these very pretty Venn diagrams, this is just a very basic representation in Wales of the percentage of the Leave votes by these national identity groups in Wales. And what you see in Wales is that Wales is incredibly heterogeneous. Okay? The largest identity group is the Welsh British, but that's only 27% of the total electorate. The second largest is the Welsh only, but that's only 1 in 4. The English British, that's 16% of the Welsh population, and so on. So you see these patterns all being reproduced in Wales. Now, Where does all this leave us, except for kind of dazzling you or, I don't know, just overwhelming you with lots of data? Basically, I think a couple of things. First of all, our views on legitimate government, how we think we should be governed, not only in terms of devolution, but in terms of our relationship with Europe, align with national identity. Okay? And they align in complicated ways, not only between the different parts of the UK, but within the different constituent units on the basis of our national identity. So that is a very, very complicated picture. And what we're seeing with Brexit, I'm afraid, is a reductionist hardline approach which is pushing people into certain categories and which is, you know, clearly not going to be viewed as legitimate by large groups within the different territories. Now, they may constitute a majority in some places, a large minority in other places, but this is an incredibly, I think, dangerous, from a kind of state unity perspective, this is a very, very dangerous perspective for those who believe in the union, because you've got these centripetal or fugal, the ones which divide, I can't even say it, it's a North Wales accent, that you've got those forces which are pulling it all apart. And like I say, when national identity and views of legitimate government align in different ways, I think you've got a real problem.
Thank you both very much for that. I think we can see quite a fractured the political landscape is at present in those presentations. Perhaps I'll give you guys an opportunity to respond now that you've heard what's been said there. To what extent do you think the United Kingdom, as we know, is being put under strain by Brexit? To what extent can it accommodate some of the drivers for Brexit that Richard and Ailsa talked about, including perhaps the renewed English nationalism, and what are the implications for devolved government?
Yeah, good question. So if I can go first. I think our entire constitution, and it feels like every bit of the fabric of our political system, whether that's the constitution, our party system, our parliamentary processes, are being stretched by the Brexit problem. If I can come back to the kind of analysis that Richard was just speaking about. Now, I've heard this being presented in different ways, but it's essentially there's a kind of a national identity explanation to Brexit. And I mean, I've thought long and hard about this over the last 3 years as somebody who was represented a seat that I found myself on the wrong side of the balance of public opinion in 2016. I've obviously spent a lot of time trying to work out why 57% of my constituents voted Leave, and I was on the minority on that occasion. And I've read and thought about the whole national identity explanation of Brexit. And I buy it, but only to a small point. Because I don't think you can explain a majorities for Brexit in places like Blaenau Gwent on that basis. Richard's nodding his head, he'll probably chip in and say, yes, you can. I think people who voted Leave, people voted for all kinds of reasons. People in their everyday lives hold multiple identities and don't necessarily think very consciously about those multiple identities. Yes, there are moments, and maybe the Brexit vote was one, when they are forced to make conscious decisions about how they prioritise those different identities. But most people, and I kind of think this is a kind of a British strength, actually, we hold these identities quite lightly. It's one of the strengths of the United Kingdom, even with, you know, passionate Welsh men and women and Scots and Irish. For most people, most of the time, it doesn't kind of drive a lot of our decision-making, I think. I don't buy the full social and economic argument explanation. I think there's a bundle of different theories that you need to help explain why certain parts of the country voted the way it did. In terms of threats to the United Kingdom stemming from that, let's start with Northern Ireland. I'm very, very worried about Northern Ireland. I think Northern Ireland was treated as an afterthought at best in the run-up to the 2016 Brexit vote. I think the whole situation around the border has shown our political establishment at Westminster up for a disastrous lack of knowledge of history, recent history, and longer-term history, and a lack of ability to have a meaningful debate about the future of Northern Ireland. So I'm worried about Northern Ireland's place in the Union. I think it's more fragile than people think. Scotland, Every time I go to Scotland, and you probably spend more time there than I do, Kieran, but every time I go there, it just feels to me like Scotland's got its own, now has its own national politics in a way that Wales doesn't. You know, it feels more like Ireland politically when I go to Scotland. Much stronger national political consciousness, stronger national political institutions, stronger national political media there as well. And Wales, well, you know, poor old Wales. I think, you know, the journey that we've been on in Wales in the last 20 years of, yes, increasing stronger national consciousness, it would take a huge leap of imagination, even with the undoubted increase in interest in nationalism that there has been in Wales, definitely, since the Brexit vote, but it's from a very, very low base. So it would take a huge leap of imagination to ever think that Wales would be leaving the United Kingdom voluntarily.
Okay, and you're touching on a couple of things they would probably come back to in terms of self-government autonomy and that sort of thing. And perhaps you might want to chip back in a minute on the Bláthnaid Gwent conundrum. But let's hear from Paul first of all.
I agree with a lot of what Stephen has said. The first few years of my life were spent in Bláthnaid Gwent, and I know Bláthnaid Gwent very well. And Bláthnaid Gwent, people often, when you ask people in England, which local authority area in Wales contains the largest number of Welsh-born people, they will say Ceredigion or Caernarfon, but it's actually Bláthnaid Gwent where the majority of Welsh-born people are. And the identification of being Welsh is very strong in Bláthnaid Gwent, but the, some of the cultural identification of being Welsh is absent, I think. So I'm very interested to hear what Richard has got to say about drilling down into identifying as Welsh. I think what Stephen says about Northern Ireland is absolutely right. And the way in which Northern Ireland has been played along in this process recently, I think is actually rather shameful. 28% of the population in the assembly elections in Northern Ireland voted for the DUP, but the DUP has this extraordinary, because of their position inside the House of Commons, has this extraordinary control over the Conservative Party, and the idea that the DUP were going to be able to veto whatever is going to come after the backstop seems to me to be quite incredible. So you have to play all the other parties in Northern Ireland into this process as well. I think I'll stop there.
Do you feel, Ailsa, that Brexit is capable of accommodating this English nationalist sentiment, which was a part of the vote to leave? And what are the implications for devolved government? Does it require almost an English parliament to settle this issue once and for all?
Oh, I think there's more than one issue there. But in terms of whether Brexit will make a difference and will satisfy kind of English nationalism, I think it's important to distinguish between English national identity and English nationalism. So what we find is that English national identity is a very strong predictor of having voted leave. And that is true after you put in all the other explanations that we know are already out there. If we go looking for the variables that help us to take into account populism and lack of efficacy and austerity and the left behinds, national identity still is important. But English national identity is slightly different from English nationalism on the one hand. And in direct response to your question, no, I don't think it's going to satisfy it. And the reason I don't think it's going to satisfy it is because of the data that we have on EVIL. So
English votes for English laws.
So not just evil as it exists out in the world. So we have been polling for years about English governance options and the English governance options that people want. And overwhelmingly, we know that when England is treated as a whole unit, the solutions are more popular. If you start carving England up into little chunks, then the solutions are less popular. And the long-running favorite was always English votes for English laws. And then English votes for English laws was introduced, and we were trying to get at whether people had noticed, and so we had all kinds of complicated split half experiments running in the survey, and what we found is that people didn't really know that it had happened, and they still wanted it. So the most popular option was introduced, and people who are strongly identified as England were particularly strongly in support of EVIL, and EVIL was introduced, and people either didn't know that it had been introduced, or even having been told that it was introduced, that it had been running, said it didn't go far enough. So I think there is a risk, whether you see it as a risk or not is I suppose depends on your view, but I think there is every possibility that what we will see with Brexit is what we have already seen with evil, that there is a demand for something, it is introduced, and it doesn't actually satisfy the people who were calling for it to begin with. And partly it's because of the detail.
And if we address that sort of question about the bigger trajectory of where we're going, which is something that Stephen touched on, do you, Richard, think, in terms of the fracturing effect of Brexit, we had Leo Varadkar talking this week about a United Ireland that raised a few eyebrows in Westminster. We haven't got an SNP MP here, but they would tell you that Brexit, in their view, strengthens the case for independence. It's getting noisier, that issue in Wales just now. Mm. Where are we heading?
Well, I mean, I think Stephen said, where does Wales fit into all of this? Because you can track a fairly straightforward narrative about Northern Ireland and about Scotland. So the Northern Ireland narrative is quite simple. The polling shows the harder the border, the more the support is for unification. And the UK government doesn't seem to be particularly bothered about that, but we know. So, you know, given that and the demographic trends, you think, well, okay, we can imagine what happens there. Scotland, again, there's a narrative about independence. Wales, as I was trying to illustrate with that final slide, is very, very complex. It is, in Wales, you have the most pro-European demographic. So fluent Welsh speakers who identify as Welsh, not British, were overwhelmingly pro-European. But as you can see there, the English diaspora in Wales is as Eurosceptic as the English population of England. So you have the extremes within Wales. I mean extremes in terms of the polls. I'm not trying to cast doubt on either side of that. I'm just saying that you've got that incredible polarisation in a population which is much more heterogeneous in terms of its national identity. And given that Stephen is shaking his head, it is just a fact that we are the most heterogeneous in terms of national identity across the UK. The Blaenau Gwent conundrum is not a conundrum. I'm not talking about place of birth. Danny Dawling got huge publicity a couple of weekends ago because he said that Brexit was to do with people born, can't remember, people buying summer houses or retiring to Gwynedd or something. Yeah. Now, this is not, I don't know where his data come from, but it's clearly nonsense. This is a national identity argument, not a place of birth argument. And Blaenau Gwent is very simple because it's strongly British and strongly Welsh. Da-da. You know, this is not a mystery here. It's about national identity in Wales as it is in Scotland, as it is in England. And if we had data from Northern Ireland, I would absolutely bet. You know, I'm a good Calvinistic Methodist. I don't bet. But if I wasn't a Calvinistic Methodist, and if I did bet, it's related to national identity in Northern Ireland as well.
We could debate 2016 for another 3.5 years. But let's take it on to what happens next, because there's issues around devolution of powers and who has the power that's repatriated from the EU after Brexit, and about money, who has the money, the Brexit dividend, to use Theresa May's phrase, that comes back. Now, one of those issues, one issue that encompasses both of those things is our EU structural funds, how that's divided up after Brexit. Perhaps, Richard, do you want to just say a little bit about what the UK government is proposing to replace them, and why that might pose problems for the devolved governments?
Yeah, and I think we can kind of link this to the public attitudes, because one of the things that is Ilse talked about grievance right at the start, and how you can see even before Brexit there was territorial grievance, a sense of we lose out or they're getting too much or so on and so forth. And we know that in terms of the attitudes that underpinned the Brexit vote in England, English identifiers who tend to be strongly Brexit supporting also feel quite resentful about Scotland's allegedly preferential treatment. I have to be very careful sitting with Ilse beside me. The allegedly preferential treatment that Scotland accepts and receives. And so it's quite, and there is no doubt at all that politically some of those who are most ardently in favour of Brexit are also deeply suspicious of devolution and would like to see the devolution clock being turned back. Now, it then gets more complicated because in Wales you have a group of people who, so the British Welsh, I know that this is not a phrase that is gaining much support to my left over here, but the British Welsh tend to be pro-Brexit but also pro-devolution. You know, which is something that my Welsh nationalist friends have real problems getting their head around. You can be both Eurosceptic and pro-devolution. The British Welsh tend to be that. The strongly Welsh only tend to be pro-devolution and pro-European. The English, British and Wales tend to be anti-devolution. So you've got these tensions, and Wales is the place where you see all of these things coming together. But the UK government's behaviour, certainly around structural funding, as the Vice Chancellor was saying, there seems to be a re-centralising move around the Shared Prosperity Fund, an attempt to build up the role of the territorial offices of state and diminish the role of the devolved institutions. And that is, you know, obviously going to create huge tensions between Cardiff and London. Ironically, the unionist administration in Cardiff feels that it's not listened to in this context. It's also going to create really major issues in terms of Whitehall. Presumably they have to find staff to run all of these things, so do they then increase the size of the Scotland office and the Wales office?
So this is about what was administered by the EU being administered somehow in the UK in future. Stephen, do you think it's viable that Westminster, the UK government, is in charge of that fund? But previously, as I understand it, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, they all had their stake in it themselves.
And there's a need basis. You know, this is the whole point about European structural funds. It's allocated on the basis of need.
So Richard is, again, slightly overplaying the argument, I think, presenting the kind of big bad UK government as trying to kind of hang on to this money and use it as a lever to dilute the devolution settlement. And that's certainly the criticism that comes from some quarters in Wales and Scotland towards the plans. But, I mean, my own government's in danger of making a bit of a mess about this. We haven't got the consultation out. They've been slow in actually coming up with a design for the Shared Prosperity Fund because it isn't as straightforward as it might appear, because what Wales has had about almost 5 billion of EU funds in the last 20 years. And yes, those funds are extremely well appreciated by the people who receive them. There is a local benefit in terms of the communities they go to, the organisations they go to, really value those European Union funds. But if you take a step back and say, do these structural funds meet the objectives for which they are created, i.e. closing the economic output gap between poorer regions and the EU average, then the economic evidence is really, really mixed. There isn't any hard evidence to suggest they're actually working to do the job that they're intended to do. So the problem, I think, that is exercising bits of Whitehall, I'll come on to the politics in a second, but there is a genuine discussion going on about, okay, how do we put these funds to better effect than what we've had in the last 20 years? I would make an argument that the EU funds haven't been as used as well in Wales as the Irish have used their funds. You've seen some really significant upscaling of infrastructure in Ireland, which we haven't seen in Wales due to the way that some of these funds have been used. So I think there's a legitimate question bit about how you design a new scheme that actually does the job that it says on the tin to raise economic performance in Wales and the other poorer regions of the UK. So that's where that discussion is at. Yes, politically, the thought that there are politicians who can, you know, what do politicians go into business for? That we like nothing better than spending taxpayers' money, particularly if you can spend it in those communities from where you come from. And yes, look, you know, Conservatives have spent 20 years kind of bemoaning the fact that lots of money gets spent in Cardiff by devolved government, who use that money to good effect politically. They are not shy about badging that money as Welsh government and making sure that it's press released and photo opportunity and all of that. And for the first time now in 20 years, there is politicians in government from Wales, Welsh Conservatives, who are looking at it and thinking, is there a political opportunity there? Let's be absolutely frank about that, in the same way that Welsh Labour politicians in Cardiff have spent 20 years using these monies politically as well. So that's where the discussion is at. I don't think there's anyone seriously wanting to unravel the devolution settlement, but it's more of a practical issue, I think, about how you spend it to better effect.
And also, SNP MPs are already calling this another power grab. Mm-hmm. Will that be another grievance in Scotland if this comes to pass?
Yeah, you see, another grievance. I mean, I think the evidence suggests that grievance is pretty omnidirectional in the UK at the moment. So I wouldn't. Certainly, the Scots have grievances, but they're not alone. They're not alone in that. And yes, I mean, there is after the referendum in 2014, there was a discussion about whether and when to have another referendum. And I think there was some careful looking at what had happened in Quebec after the very, very close referendum in 1995. And in Quebec, there was a focus on the winning conditions. You know, we're not going to have a third one until we know we have the winning conditions. And I think there is some attentiveness to this notion of winning conditions in Scotland as well. But if you were trying to identify what the winning conditions would be, one would be a lead in the polls, but the other would be a union and a UK government that doesn't seem overly keen on listening to different parts of the union. And I think in some ways, the winning conditions are things that you can create yourself, and in other cases they are entirely external to your control. And I think, you know, were I the Scottish Government and looking to see if there were conditions that were outside of my control that might actually help attract people to my cause, then you're not exactly short of them at the moment, I would say.
And Paul, do you see Brexit creating grievances within the devolved governments and the people of those nations and regions that weren't there before?
Well, I think that I'm a great believer, and perhaps this is not very good scholarly terms, in seeing individuals as important in these things. And I think that David Cameron, I think, got devolution. He understood devolution. I don't think Theresa May did. And from what I observe now, the present Prime Minister doesn't either. When David Lidington was the minister who had responsibility for these things, he did understand certainly Wales. I think he understood Scotland, he understood Northern Ireland. He was a senior minister in the cabinet. I don't think there's anybody taking that role now. I think Michael Gove has it, but he has other things to do as well. So I suspect that the eye is very much off the ball at present. I mean, there are other balls, obviously very big balls that are being played elsewhere. I suspect that the fact that, for example, there's been no document produced, which should have been produced on the review of the common frameworks, should have been out a few weeks ago, hasn't come out. I suspect that's because there's not as much work being done on those things as there ought to have been done. So all of that will lead to greater grievance in the future, if you have people in London who are not really paying attention to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland.
Do you want to offer a defence for Boris Johnson's attitude towards devolution, Stephen?
I'm not going to defend anything about Boris Johnson. He'll fight for himself when he comes down to Wales, and no doubt people will question him on all of these things. Just on the point about grievance, when I was Secretary of State for Wales, you know, we used to have this kind of tug of war going on with the Welsh Government in Cardiff, and Carwyn Jones was First Minister then. And it almost became a bit of a running joke about the different phrases that would get used every single time from Welsh Government to anything we did as UK Government. And we'd always play a kind of devolution grievance bingo. You know, it's a snub, a slap in the face for Wales. It's a rolling back of the devolution settlement. And Carwyn Jones and I used to joke about this. We used to have Monday morning meetings together. And I can remember one meeting we were talking about the embryonic Wales Bill at the time. And Carwyn said to me, "Look, well, whatever you do, it'll be a snub or a slap in the face." And he made a joke of it. And so there's a little bit of theatre that goes along with it as well. And yes, there are deep underlying issues, and I don't want to downplay that. But you know, the people in Cardiff Bay, I can't speak for Edinburgh, but certainly my dealings with Welsh Government, you're dealing with people who are intensely political.
If you were still Secretary of State for Wales, would you want to be administering those funds? Would you want that control, irrespective of the demands coming from Holyrood and Cardiff Bay?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't, certainly not from the Wales office. And I wouldn't want those funds to be certainly not administered in totality from Westminster anyway. The bulk would have to go to Cardiff, respecting the devolution settlement. But look, there's a practical problem here. And 20 years of devolution, we still haven't worked out in Wales. How do we do big infrastructure spending? And the problem is that when you're kind of slicing 3 or 4% of a budget to kind of pass down to Wales, that doesn't give you enough money to Welsh Government to do any of the big, big projects. And we've seen very, very few of them in Wales in the last 20 years. To do big, meaningful infrastructure interventions, you need lumpy spending. But if actually what you're doing is diluting down the pot just to make sure you're obeying the strict devolution funding principles, I think there's a practical issue there of whether Welsh Government has got the ability.
I don't want to, I know when you say I have respect for, you really don't mean it, but I genuinely have respect for Stephen, but you can't get away with that. The big cancelled infrastructure plans in Wales in the last few years have been the electrification of the rail network to the west of Cardiff, that was the UK government. The Swansea Lagoon, that was the UK government.
Richard, you're making a different argument here.
But this is about big infrastructure projects in Wales, and they're cancelled by the UK government.
I remember talking to someone who was quite involved in the Millennium Stadium project, and I think about 50 million of that funding came from the Millennium Commission at the time, which was obviously set to have big projects that celebrated the turning of 2000. And he made the point to me that if that money had just been devolved down across to Wales on a 3 or 4% basis or whatever, there probably wouldn't have been enough money to give all of that to, for that, you know, there were two big projects in Wales that benefited from that funding, the Millennium Centre and the Millennium Stadium. You couldn't have done that. So there's an argument to be made for central interventions, recognising that there's a strategic project to be done in Wales. And look,
Isn't that argument itself, because European funds, and everyone will have their own stake in it, would be a decision made by Westminster rather than everyone making that decision together. Can I just, we've got to get to the Q&A eventually, I'd like to ask, I think Richard, first of all, do you see Brexit creating greater friction between the various devolved administrations and maybe even English regional government?
Well, I think it's certainly creating greater frictions. I think there's, you know, that's simply obvious, and it's likely to continue. One of the things that I think is one of the kind of current myths is that we get Brexit over and done with, and somehow we can move back to politics as normal. If Brexit is about who we think we are and who we think we're not, then this thing is likely to continue. I think the English regional government, as Ailsa was saying earlier, the problem with English regional government is it seems great on paper, but the English really don't want it. Mm. And that is a fairly fatal kind of problem. And those people like Paul over here who are arguing for a different kind of constitutional order for the UK are always coming head to head with the problem of England. And England is so big, 84% of the whole. So a federal system with England as a unit seems unbalanced. The obvious alternative is to regionalise England, but the English don't want it. And you can't force them to accept regional government. And so that is the kind of the central problem in terms of trying to imagine a different kind of Britain.
And do we risk arbitrary fights over EU powers just for the sake of having them?
No, I don't think it's an arbitrary fight. I mean, there was a referendum that had a result. We have to resolve that. We have to accept that it occurred, and we have to move on. So I don't think
in the way that
struggling,
those powers are repatriated.
No, I don't think struggling with how that happened, even if we're arguing about how that happened, I don't think that's in vain. I think ignoring it would be deeply troubling. Just on that last point about whether we risk kind of broad level conflict among the different administrations, I think one thing that's worth noting that in addition to being a union of grievance, The UK is also, to a certain extent, a union of ignorance. Because if you look at the don't knows, if you ask people questions about different parts of the UK and you also give them the option to say they don't know, the don't knows are often very high. That's just one thing that's generally true. But they're lowest when you're asking people about their own region, the region where they're from, or you're asking about England. So people feel confident saying something about what they want and what they think and what they think is happening in their own region and what they want and what they think is happening in England, and the rest of the union is a bit of a black box, right? But that, I think, reflects the fact that for many people, the union is not lived as a union of four different parts, but a series of bilateral unions involving England. Mm. And I mean, that's not my point or our point, that's James Mitchell's point. But I think that can feed into this. And I think England plays a double role in that kind of collective imagination, one as England, and also this alignment with or this illusion with the UK government itself. So I don't see a capacity for greater friction among all of the units, but there is quite possibly a capacity for increased bilateral friction, all of it involving either England in one formulation or the UK government in another.
Paul, is Brexit compatible with the smooth running of devolution?
Well, the Prime Minister said that when we've got Brexit over and done with, then everything will be back to smooth running. So, you know, there is a view that obviously he ostensibly holds that is going to happen. Personally, I think that the possibility of the reunification of Ireland has shot up the political agenda. The possibility of a yes vote in a Scottish, even if the present government doesn't allow an order to allow another referendum, the next Scottish election will be a proxy for a referendum. That has gone up the agenda, and that leaves us in a very uncomfortable position, I think, in Wales, because, as Carwyn Jones has said, having a union of England and Wales, perhaps in 20 years' time, is a very strange union. And that, I think, then opens up the question of whether we become more reintegrated into an England and Wales with less devolution or similar sorts of devolution to the cities of Wales as is now planned for the cities of England.
Just England and Wales were the sole members of the union.
And
potentially.
And as one unit then, rather than two units.
How do you feel about that, Stephen?
Well, that's not a happy prospect at all for me. I'm someone who believes in the United Kingdom, recognising, though, that it's a pretty short-lived phenomenon if you take a step back and look at the full sweep of the last 1,000 years of history. So we don't take any of it for granted.
Can I ask about chlorinated chicken? Because no Brexit debate is going to be about chlorinated chicken. But I wonder about this idea of divergence after Brexit as the powers come back and each devolved government has its own take on these things. Can you do a trade deal with chlorinated chicken and Brexit and devolved government as it is?
One thing we know is that people don't like policy variation. And that is true particularly in England. They want policies to be the same across the whole of the UK. It is slightly less true in Scotland and Wales. But even in Scotland and Wales, where there is devolution, there is still a considerable proportion of the electorate that wants policy to be the same across the UK, which is surprising if you think of other federal countries where policy variation is I know the UK is not a federal country, but if you think of places where there are legislative competence to intervene in particular areas, policy variation is just a fact of life. But one thing that's quite interesting, last year we asked about policy variation in the UK, and we got the same numbers that we always do. People want a fair amount of policy uniformity. But we also asked about policy uniformity between the UK after it leaves the EU and the EU. And what we found was that voters, even Leave voters, wanted more policy uniformity between the UK and the EU it leaves than the UK. And that, I think, is the point at which, you know, sometimes we look at the data and we think, we don't know what's going on here. So the policy uniformity confuses us sometimes because there is a principle there and yet there is deep disquiet about it. We also know that people want the region to be more important and to have more say, but they're often not always willing to accept the natural logical consequences of that, which is policy variation. And that's what we call the devolution paradox. You want your region to be powerful, but you want your region to come up with the exact same conclusions and the exact same policies as the region next door.
And what potential problems are thrown up then, Richard, by policy variation in terms of actually delivering any form of Brexit that honours some of those referendum promises?
Well, I mean, I think that's a fascinating question, and it goes back, actually, links to something that Stephen said earlier about, he mentioned how conscious people were in making decisions. What was the thought process in terms of coming to a decision about Brexit and thinking about the future constitutional order? And I think that the point is that lots of what's going on is based on unconscious assumptions about who we are and where we fit into the world. And so as we've, Ilse and I have just finished a book on Englishness, looking at, and it's focused on, which is quite, I like the irony of somebody in Cardiff and Edinburgh working together on a book about Englishness. But what you find is some really striking sets of expectations about where a post-Brexit Britain would fit into the world. Mm. And there's a very strong, for example, hankering after bits of the empire, and it's the white bits of the empire. It's a very strongly racialized element, and a sense that the English-speaking, what used to be called the white Commonwealth, is waiting for us,
and the dominions,
and we will re-emerge. And these are, and I don't think it's conscious in the sense of it's a set of assumptions about who we are and we fit into the world. And the problem with that is when it collides with the reality of the extraordinary complexity of trade deals, which take years and involve, you know, thousands of pages of complicated argument and negotiation and concessions and losing things that you think are important, like, you know, for example, if there's a free trade deal with Australia and New Zealand, bang goes my family's sheep farms, all of them. There's no chance, you know, they've got no chance in that context. So when that kind of, these kind of broad brush notions of who we are and we fit into the world will collide with the reality of trade negotiations with tough, hard-headed people, I think that the potential for disappointment is huge, but the question is, where does that go? And of course, the danger is it turns into a narrative of betrayal. And that's, you know, that's a key worry here, is it turns into a story of, if only it had been done properly, if the right people had been doing Brexit, it would all have been different. So I think that's the, for me, it's where romance meets pointy-headed reality. That's the real danger in all of this.
Okay, unless anyone wants to come back in on that point, let's open it out to the floor. Succinct questions, please. Don't want too many monologues. You sort of tee them up and it'll knock them out of the park. So where's the microphone? Great.
Yes, please. Thanks, Richard.
Who wants to go first?
Thank you.
You're not going to make me ask another half an hour. <with you. laughs> There we go. Oh, no, it's made its way over there. You can go next.
Yeah, to what extent do you think age, as it did in the Brexit referendum as a whole, played out as a factor across the devolved regions? How did it break down when you brought age into the question as well as identity?
Right, well, that might be a question for our...
Fast one, older people voted leave, younger people voted remain, and that remains true even when you control for national identity. And national identity remains a significant predictor of behaviour even when you add in age.
Okay.
So they're both still present.
Does that mean, Stephen, there's a danger of the kind of Brexit franchise sort of dying on us, basically, and the younger generation inheriting a country that they don't particularly like the look of?
Well, people used to say that 20 years ago, when the Conservative Party had no MPs at all in Wales and Scotland, and you know, people would suggest that, you know, the Conservative vote will die out. But there's lots of evidence to suggest that as people get older, and their value sets modified to some extent, and actually they become more conservative, small c, and Big C, and it might be that as people get older they become more Brexity, but we'll see. You know, we're still at the very early stages of this.
Yeah. But I doubt whether the romance of Brexit, which Richard referred to, the romance, the attraction of empire, that is something that surely is dying. That young people, as they get older, will not suddenly become adherents of the Dominions back again.
Paul, I've had thousands of conversations with people in Wales and elsewhere about Brexit vote in 2016, and none of them have talked about romance of an empire. There's lots of nostalgia in the Brexit conversation, of course there is.
And most relationships fade.
I've come across nobody who seriously places any value on the idea that we're going to resurrect the empire 2.0 or anything like that.
Right, so. This gentleman over here.
I think Professor Wynne-Jones said at the beginning England was simple. I just wonder whether the data for Stoke and the data for Islington would be similar.
Mm. Do you want to take that? That's the regional variation. Do you want to?
No, you can go.
Yeah. Pursue. So this is an excellent question, and it's one we get a lot in terms of whether how homogeneous is England if we're looking at territorial differences. And so we've looked at this a number of different ways, and every time we look at it, we get exactly the same answer, which is there aren't regional differences across England in terms of the link between what we call devo anxiety, a sense of grievance about the devolution settlement, and Euroscepticism, and the link between those two things and national identity. But the exception to that is London. So outside of London, England behaves on these issues remarkably similarly. I'm not saying that there aren't other differences, but in terms of the relationship between devo anxiety and Euroscepticism, so the merging of the two understandings of England's place in these two unions, and the relationship between those two, the attitudes to those two unions and English national identity, that pattern is the same throughout England with the exception of London.
Excellent. Does that apply within Wales and Scotland as well? If you take like a capital city, for example, Edinburgh or Cardiff out of the picture.
Our data isn't as good on Wales, because Wales. But you know, one thing which does unite Wales is a sense that Cardiff gets too much. That starts in Castell Coch and basically keeps going until you get to Connah's Quay. So that is certainly common ground. But doing much in terms of territorial variation, given in particular the complexity that you have in Wales, we need somebody to give us more money to get bigger samples, basically.
If you're listening out there.
whoever's watching the live stream.
Crowdfunding,
okay, this gentleman here, then we've got a couple more questions here.
Okay. So I'd like to take this back to the title of tonight, is Brexit the end of devolution? And I'd like to look at this from the point of view of the Welsh Government. So this may be difficult for Stephen, but I'd like you all to imagine that you are the constitutional advisor to the First Minister of Wales. What can the Welsh Government do in the very difficult situation in which we find ourselves in terms of the constitutional order and perhaps promoting change in the constitutional order, and what should they be doing?
Stephen, I think that was for you, was it?
No, I think it wasn't for me.
was it for you? Oh. Okay, I see.
For me, I think the Welsh Government has played an active part in questions that have come before the Supreme Court. I mean, they intervened in the Miller 2, and I suspect we're going to see, as Rick knows, I'm not a lawyer, he is, I suspect we're going to see a lot more of that sort of legalisation of the constitutional order, and the Welsh Government, and I'm sure the Scottish Government, are going to be active in doing that.
That's an interesting point, just for a couple of remarks, maybe, because we've had a lot of talk, haven't we, in the last few weeks about a written constitution for the UK, and I wonder where devolution settlement comes into
it. I think Rick's question is such an interesting one, and I think the Welsh Government has tried, and I'm not sure whether Stephen will agree or disagree with this, but I view the Welsh Government as having tried to engage constructively with Brexit. That was there was a awareness that Wales had voted to leave, obviously, so that meant that they had to engage with what Brexit would look like rather than say no, no, no. And therefore there were lots of kind of constructive speeches, and I used to go and listen to people at the IFG, the Institute for Government around the corner, and Carwyn Jones would suggest this, that and the other. And basically there was nobody was listening. And one of the issues which I think has been touched upon by Paul is, you know, who in the UK government is there to listen? When you had David Lidington, for example, as Deputy Prime Minister, he had a kind of a functional role in trying to make these things work. But where strategically in the UK government in Whitehall, where are they thinking about these things in a joined up way? And it's far from obvious where that place is. Now, of course, they've kind of decided they're not getting anywhere this, and have now come out saying Welsh Labour will campaign. They want a second referendum. They want a campaign to remain. The problem they have is there's no credible threat. You know, Scotland has a credible threat. We're all too well aware that Northern Ireland has got far too many threats in all kinds of ways. But there is a real issue for the Welsh Government. My advice to the constitutional expert is, best of luck to you, mate, because I think it's very, very difficult.
It's going to be very difficult to get anything done positively around the Constitution, I think, in the next 5 or 10 years. You know, Brexit is going to dominate our institutions and our political argument and debate in this country for at least that period of time. And as we've seen with so many other issues, the bandwidth is almost entirely occupied by doing Brexit. And once we've got the first stage of the exit process out of the way, we'll be on to trade deals and all of the complexity and of that. I do agree with Richard. You know, this whole Brexit experience in the last 3 years has shone a spotlight on just how threadbare and thin some of our processes are within our institutions and within the Constitution for dealing with common problems. And please don't think I'm kind of come from a position of complete bias against Welsh Government. I think it is fair to say they made a fair stab at trying to grapple positively and constructively post the Brexit vote, and I think they found it increasingly frustrating. And our system of doing business with the devolved administrations shouldn't rely on having one particularly effective individual like David Lidington, or the balance of personalities. Our whole kind of the joint ministerial council approach, which was started right at the start of the devolution period, I mean, that's so far out of date already. And there does need to be a serious rethinking about how the First Minister of Scotland, the First Minister of Wales can look the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom in the eye as an equal and have a meaningful and grown-up conversation about shared problems, because those mechanisms don't really work at the moment.
Elsa, you want to come in briefly?
Yes, I mean, I was just going to say, for a country with this constitutional architecture, its intergovernmental relations are entirely underdeveloped. And I think this is one consequence of the fact that you had Labour or Labour-led administrations at the time that the devolved institutions were set up. And there was an overwhelming sense, I mean, there were concordats at the time, but I think there was an overwhelming sense that it's all right, we're all of the same party, we'll all just muddle through. And that works under certain conditions, and one of those conditions is, yes, everyone is the same partisan stripe, and the other condition is that it's very much business as normal. But we know we don't have the same partisan stripe in all the administrations at the moment, and it's very much not business as usual. So I think some of this is linked just to Brexit, but some of it actually was already an issue and probably would have popped up at some time or another, and Brexit has just revealed it to be the case.
So we must be grateful to Brexit for giving us the opportunity to address that.
Yes. We like referendums.
Questions in front of it.
I want to ask about the potential for centralisation of funding. Take us back to something Stephen referred to, which was the UK government being quite tempted to the idea of more control. If you go back to prior to the establishment of devolution, I can remember very fierce party political arguments about the way in which EU funding was spent in Wales versus England. The interpretation that the UK government had put on the criteria for regeneration funding. Now that went away when that power was given to, that money was given directly to the Welsh Government. Because EU funding, the criteria is decided on such a wide scale that it isn't seen as party political. So what I would like to ask is, does the panel think that actually if the UK government were to take on too much of the role of distribution and with tight criteria of regeneration funding, might it not actually prove to be a really poison chalice?
Eric Stephen.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Jenny, and I largely agree with it. Of course, the flip side of the coin of what you described, the fact that under the EU framework there was no sense of party political priorities. I mean, the other side of that coin is a weak sense of accountability. And I remember, right at the start of the referendum campaign in 2016, having a conversation with David Cameron, and of course I was Secretary of State for Wales at the time, and his assumption was that EU funding to Wales, coupled with agricultural support payments in Wales, would be the thing that would get the majority of votes in Wales to support the EU. And it's, no one's really worked out why those areas that have had the most EU funds spent on it in the last 20 years voted most strongly to leave. And I suspect, actually, for most people, most voters in those areas, EU funding was pretty meaningless. They didn't genuinely directly themselves feel the benefit, maybe indirectly, but there was no sense of direct accountability or control over these funds that they kept seeing EU signs around their communities. So there's a weakness there. I mean, just final point on this, the dog that has never really barked in terms of devolution in Wales is pushing powers downwards. There's been a drawing down of powers to Cardiff, from Westminster, but there's pushing powers further down to the community level. Welsh Government have been very resistant at doing that, and I wonder whether there is an opportunity with the Shared Prosperity Fund to get those funds distributed in a really meaningful way to actually empower local authorities more with it.
Do you see that as coming from Westminster? Westminster requiring that, or something that the Welsh Government would choose to do?
Well, we'd hope the Welsh Government would choose to do that. I mean, I don't think Westminster should get into the business of trying to lay down the law on the design of these funds. The portion of the funds that go to Wales should be decided by Welsh Government in Wales, but I think it would be a pretty smart thing to do for them to think creatively about how they use local authorities more.
Do you want to come in?
Well, just very briefly, I mean, I think one of the key things here, which I alluded to briefly, but I think it's worth returning to, is that the UK government appears to have given up on the idea of distributing according to need. And from a Welsh perspective, that is obviously disastrous.
They haven't given up. They said they're going to distribute on the basis of need.
Do
they use the same definition that the EU currently has? Because if you start to get into a Barnett formula,
What Jenny was alluding to is deciding who deserves to get this money was highly politicised. And there will be, given that lots of these areas don't vote for the current party of government in the UK, if there is any sense that money is being taken away from those communities, even if there's a sense that it hasn't made much of a difference or it hasn't been spent well, if there's a sense that that money is being taken away unfairly, then you watch the political sparks fly. So I think Jenny's absolutely right that this could be a poison chalice, but it is absolutely something that the UK government felt after 2014. If you spoke to people around Whitehall after the 2014 independence referendum, there was a sense we need to show what the union does for these places. And so that's a very strong sense that you get talking to people around Whitehall. And so I think there are lots of reasons to think that this is the direction they're going to go into, even though there are major problems, I think, if they do that.
Yes, I got a question really for Richard Wynne-Jones, and it's about his analysis. There's one thing I think is missing from that is ethnic minorities. I mean, it has to be recognised that ethnic minorities are now a bigger British population than the Welsh, the Scottish or the Irish. And I think it's probable that few of them would describe themselves as English only, Welsh only, Irish or Scottish only. So do we know what influence they had, if they were indeed British onlys, Have you broken down what influence they had in terms of how they voted and what the consequences are?
Yeah, I don't. I'm just very briefly. Obviously, I couldn't cover everything in three slides, but there is definitely very strong evidence that in England, BME populations tend to identify as British rather than as English, and that is part of the explanation for the London difference that that Ilse was talking about. So London tends to be more British and less English relative to the rest of England. We don't have evidence in Wales. We just have never had a survey vehicle with a big enough sample to say anything meaningful about the BME population in Wales. However,
we know we're in exactly the same position in Scotland. However, one thing we do know a bit more about is in terms of place of birth and its role in the 2014 referendum, and that was quite interesting. If you looked at the behaviour of people who were born in Scotland, a slight majority voted yes, and I mean slight within the low 50s. If you looked at people who were not born in Scotland and who were born in the rest of the UK, they were the most likely to vote no, overwhelmingly likely to vote no. It's like 70%, 70-30. And if you looked at people who were not born in Scotland but were born outside the UK, they were between the two. So in terms of their engagement with the political process, in terms of their subjective knowledge, people who were born elsewhere in the UK were more like those born in Scotland. But if you looked at terms of their constitutional attitudes, those born outside of the UK were actually closer to those born in Scotland than were those who were born in England, Wales, or Northern Ireland. So there's all kinds of layers there. And I know it's a completely different issue to ethnicity, but these are the ways that we're trying to tease at some of the variation that we find. Because our argument is basically that people are misunderstanding what's happening in Britain and what's happening in the UK because they're looking at UK-wide data or British data, and they're not looking below. And that is true also when you get to the level of looking at Wales and looking at Scotland and looking at England. You have to look below.
Okay, thank you very much. Another question at the back.
My question is for the two professors. Obviously, well, I presume that the figures that they put before us and formed the basis of their discussion represented the attitudes that were defined or determined at the time of the vote in 2016. Can they tell us if they have since then more up-to-date analysis of how people's feelings are? Have people, for example, found that they're not prepared, or they might now realize that there's cyanide in the Kool-Aid, so they're not going to drink it anymore?
Cyanide Kool-Aid.
From chlorinated chicken.
Yeah, from chlorinated chicken to we have Ilse mentioned that, but I think the kerfuffle with the slides may have meant that we missed that, is that we have a big set of surveys in the field now. We've just got the Welsh, Scottish and English data back, and we're still in the field in Northern Ireland, and we're dying to tell you about what's in the new data, but we can't, because we want the Northern Ireland data to be collected first before we start talking about it. I think that the there's so much we want to tell you about it, but I think the
give us one little tidbit.
Well, one thing we could say is that there's nothing in those data that would lead us to believe that our previous analysis was wrong.
Okay.
So we can say that.
There has been, there has, you know, even if you take the commercially available commercial opinion polls, yes, there has been a drift in a Remain direction, but it hasn't been a kind of a very significant shift. It's a drift rather than a big shift. Attitudes have, in some ways, have hardened on either side of the divide. I've just published a piece in Welsh talking about the culture camp, the culture war, and you know, I think that we are embedded in camps where it's about who we think we are and who we think we're not, and politics has become very, very polarised on that basis. And at the moment, the politicians who try to bridge the gap, you know, it's the old Aneurin Bevan quip about people in the middle of the road get run over at the moment. And so I don't think there has been that fundamental change. It may happen, as I said, when when reality hits, when the complication of the 2,000-page trade deal with New Zealand hits Welsh farmers, who knows? But we're a long way from that.
Yes, Stephen.
If I jump in on the back of that, beware newspapers coming from a certain point of view that want to overinterpret polling data. And you see it on both sides of the argument. I think the Evening Standard are running a headline today saying that Britain or London's, certainly Britain's changed its mind. And there was a headline in the Independent newspaper just months after the referendum in 2014 announcing Wales had changed its mind on Brexit. That was literally the headline. And it was on the back of, I think it was the Wales Barometer poll, which suggested that a majority of people in Wales didn't now support Brexit. But actually all the polls have done, as far as I can tell, is go back to what they were prior to the referendum campaign. No opinion poll ever showed a majority in favour of leaving the EU until we got into the meat of the campaign, and that's when people started to harden up their views. So, pinch of salt.
Okay, this gentleman here.
Thanks. Much of the reasoned discussion so far seems to me to be based against the context of an ordered Brexit and then an orderly cascade of issues that affect the evolution. Does it look differently through the lens of a no-deal, messy Brexit?
Paul?
Well, there's a very interesting piece which Michael Kenny at Cambridge University has produced about the consequences of a no-deal Brexit, which he argues will be catastrophic for the Union. His argument is that will lead to an ineluctable demand for Irish reunification, for Scottish independence, and as I said before, will leave us in Wales in a very uncomfortable place.
Is there something else you can't tell us?
Yeah, so last year's data, we asked about this, and Richard mentioned this already, that the harder the Brexit, and including a no-deal Brexit, the greater the support for reunification of Ireland. We do know that. What was the point just immediately before that? Because it made me think of Scotland. This is a memory test.
Can you remember what you said?
Messy no-deal Brexit.
Scotland, in terms of Scotland, yeah. So one would think that a no-deal Brexit would be a gift to those who are hoping for another independence referendum and hoping that the yes side will win. And certainly it does provide the push factor that provides kind of an emotional rejection of the United Kingdom. However, we also know it creates economic conditions of risk that are much more risky than were the case in 2014, and we know that risk mattered in the 2014 referendum, and we know in particular that economic risk mattered in terms of market access, but also in terms of EU membership. So on the one hand, you might think that if you're on the fence on independence in Scotland, no deal Brexit is a total nightmare. Let's pull the parachute cord and we'll float off into a happier future. But the economic reality of that is that a no deal Brexit also creates new barriers that were not there before last time round. So you might want it more, but it seems less attainable in some ways. So I think it's not a straight one-to-one relationship in terms of no-deal Brexit makes Scottish independence more likely, because it does also create very real problems.
Can I have a less intelligent, more visceral response to that? So I mentioned earlier sheep farming family and so on. I mean, the scenario which I've got in my head is if we have an exit, a disorderly exit in the next few weeks, and you're looking at peak lamb sales coming up soon, no market, collapse of the industry, basically. It seems that, I mean, many people in this room will remember the appalling foot and mouth experience in Wales, and the slaughter of animals and the burning of carcasses and the, you know, and this sounds apocalyptic, and that certainly looked apocalyptic, felt at the time, but I think you are talking about scenarios where if you've got no market for these animals, you are going down, and I think it's very, very hard to judge how the politics of that play out. You asked about devolution. Foot and mouth actually made Welsh devolution in some important ways. It was a crisis that had an important salutary effect within the civil service. I think it those rural communities which were dealing with the Welsh Government at the time thought they did a decent job of an almost impossible situation. But I have no idea, if we're facing that kind of scenario, where markets simply disappear, as they would for red meat, given the tariffs, this is simply obvious. It's very hard to work out the politics, because I think emotions will be so high that I think it's genuinely worrying, frightening prospect.
Who is still itching to ask a question? Or are we complete? Okay.
It's the nibbles. It's the nibbles.
Yeah, I'm curious about one thing that Stephen said earlier, because you began talking about national identity, and Stephen kind of disagreed with that
to a point.
Yeah, so I wonder what identity do you think was prevalent in that vote then, since we have a few minutes?
Well, different identities, but amongst the farming community, we've talked a bit about hill farmers in Wales and sheep farming. A lot of farmers in Wales voted to leave the EU. And David Cameron and I had gone round Wales talking about risks to Welsh farming if we left the EU. And there's almost like two different conversations were going on. There were the kind of economic rational arguments that we were trying to put across, now labelled Project Fear. And I remember going to the GE factory just north of Cardiff on a Friday afternoon with David Cameron, and he was doing this whole thing where he rolls up his sleeves, and a brilliant speech, really passionate, kind of giving all of his kind of intellectual and emotional energy into it. There's probably 300 factory workers, many lads and blokes stood there looking at us, and I could just see how hard David Cameron was working to get across the arguments about how important EU markets were to Welsh manufacturing, Welsh farming, all of that stuff. And you could just see on the faces of these people in this factory on a Friday afternoon how little of it was sinking in. And we got in the back of the car, and David Cameron said to me, how do we think we did there? I said it was 50-50. He said it was nowhere near as good as that, he said. We were almost talking a different language. We were talking the language of economics, and out there people were talking about the language of take back control. And it was a kind of political, emotional. The Leave campaign won because they sounded more patriotic to a lot of people, not everyone. Sounded more optimistic and spoke a language that a lot of people felt they understood, getting back more control over their lives. And it worked in the Rhondda, it worked in West Wales, it worked in Essex, and it worked in Sunderland.
I think that's a classic example of, and we know this from the literature across multiple referendums, that national identity can disrupt messages about risk. We know that voters are risk averse, we know that there is a status quo bias in referendums, but we also know that community, an attachment to a community, a sense of national identity, can disrupt that message so that you can actively take decisions that are not in your economic interest because you think it's important for your community. And I don't see that as working against national identity. I see that as just another example of that same pull of community. Who takes the choices? We take the choices. And that's the funny thing about things in Scotland. Nationalists in Scotland, people who want independence in Scotland, will intuitively get that argument if you're talking about independence, but they don't sometimes get that same argument, that argument was present in terms of Brexit. Who takes the decisions? We take the decisions. And that is a strong pull of community and a strong marker of voice, and that can disrupt all these rational economic arguments about what's in your self-interest, what's in your community's economic interest.
Okay, right. I think that's a good. Do you want to have
I'm sure. A man who stands between an audience and their nipples.
Okay, well, I think that's probably a good time to wrap up. We've talked about cyanide, chlorinated chicken, grievances, independence, and I'm not sure if we've necessarily answered this question, but I think we get a sense that there may be troubled times ahead, to say the least. So thank you all to our very distinguished Diva Royalty panel.
I'm the person who's going to stand between your ears. I have a few things to say. Thank you very much indeed to Kieran for chairing this really interesting conversation, first of all. Paul, Steve and Richard and Elsa too. one of the things that came up earlier on was how you frame the question really matters. And I think obviously we're delighted, together with our friends at Cardiff University, that we framed the question really well for this evening's discussion. I'm Auriel Miller, I'm the director of the IWA. And I think I just want to make a few reflections on the conversation. One is perspectives really matter. It sounds very obvious, but where you sit in the country or in these four countries really, really matters. Who am I? Where do I belong? Who should govern me? I think the who am I, where do I belong is a fundamental question. Who should govern me is becoming much more of a fundamental question. And the assumptions that we're making about different people and about each other. Our purpose in these debates is to have a more thoughtful conversation about issues that are incredibly topical. We have these amazing conversations, I was saying to a few people earlier on, with our friends and colleagues at Cardiff University about 4 or 5 months prior to each debate, thinking, what issue shall we discuss in 5 months' time? And pretty much every time we're on the button, I think, and particularly so at the moment. But what we want is a more thoughtful conversation, because I think the fact that this is such a heated public discourse at the moment, having cool, calm observations about what people are thinking and feeling is incredibly important, as is better listening to each other and our points of views. The money obviously matters, and I think there'll be more to come on that conversation in terms of the Shared Prosperity Fund. And I think the thing for us at the IWA that we'll be keeping a close eye on is how it impacts on the lives of people living and working in Wales both now and in the future. And that's whatever their national identity, actually. Whatever each of our national identities, and particularly now, at the moment, as 1 in 4 people in Wales are living in poverty before we leave. So I think those are the things that we need to bear in mind. I have some thank yous to say to the Vice-Chancellor and to Cardiff University for an fantastic ongoing partnership, we really appreciate. To Ben and the Arup team, to Laura and the IWA team who put on these debates. Our purpose in the debate series is to have robust conversation about tricky issues. This is the third in a series that we've been doing over the last few years in London. It's important for us to be talking about issues that matter in Wales and elsewhere in the UK, and not only in Wales. So yes, we got some stick for doing it here, but actually we want to do it here for particular reasons, and that's super important too. Our role is to offer both a platform for independent comment and debate, politically independent too. Our policy research work focuses on 3 new themes for us. One being a successful, clean, green and fair economy for Wales, explicitly fair. Secondly, high-performing, responsive public services. And thirdly, a strong, confident democracy. And I think that confidence is increasingly apparent. The highlights from this session, I know they are being live streamed, and they'll be available on various Twitter channels and YouTube places afterwards. But the highlights from these sessions will be shared with a number of committees who we think will be very interested in what the conversation has been here this evening. So thank you for contributing. I want to give a shout out to Professor Margaret Arnott, who's going to be doing a really brilliant piece of work, or is already doing a really brilliant piece of work for us, on interparliamentary relations. Margaret, can you give us a wave from over there? Thank you. I know you've interviewed some people in the room already. On interparliamentary relations in the future. And on the constitutional issues that this sort of debate has given focus to, I think. I also would like to ask that if you're not already a member of the IWA, and I know a number of you are, so thank you very much indeed, do please consider joining. If you're buying a monthly cup of coffee, or even a weekly cup of coffee, I think it is, we'd love to have you with us, because we're about the same sort of price. We run on an absolute shoestring, and my colleague Clear here, it's a wave clear, is available to take your hard-earned pounds in membership, because never has it been more important to have cool, calm, level-headed observations and commentary on what's going on around us at the moment. So Jochen Bauer, everybody, thank you very much indeed. Do join us for a drink outside. Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.